It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. Everyone who loves skiing is watching the sky these days. Even a lot of people who don't love snow admit that Anchorage is a pretty gloomy place in November when we don't have snow to relieve the darkness. For avid skiers and winter sports folks, the wait for snow can become unbearable. So today we've got a discussion about snow. We're not going to jinx it. We are bowing respectfully in the direction of the snow gods, but we're going to learn a lot about snow to inform the anticipation with some science. And I've got three terrific guests in the studio today who know tons about this subject from three different perspectives, and all are skiers of various levels. And so, as of course am I, and so this is it. We're going to just talk about nothing but snow for the next hour. So, and I realize outside it is not snowing, and it doesn't look like it's gonna for a while. So this is probably the closest you're gonna get. We've got with us Travis Rector, who's a professor of astronomy and physics at UAA. Thanks for being with us, Travis.
Thank you.
And Travis is a master skier and a very fast one. Dylan Watts is a coach at the APU Nordic Ski Center and expert on skiing and waxing. Thanks for being with us, Dylan.
Hi, Charles. Great to be here.
And Gene Petrescu is a regional scientist with the National Weather Service and does not have good news for us. There's no snow in the forecast, or no substantial snow in the forecast, right, Gene?
That's correct. There may be some chances for a little bit, especially tomorrow night and Saturday, and maybe a little bit later in the weekend. But there's no big storm on the horizon.
Yeah, and it's very warm and wet, unseasonably so. It would appear.
Yeah, October's been just phenomenally warm. It looks like it's going to end up being in the top three warmest Octobers on the period of record in Anchorage, and actually, you know, most of the state, the same story. It's in the top five warmest pretty much everywhere except for Southeast Alaska.
Hmm. I was seeing that 62 degrees in Delta Junction, which broke their old record by 19 degrees, which is huge. So it's really like fall is really hanging on, and I guess the ground is still warm, and it's just not promising for snow to stick when it's like this at all.
Well, you know, since, you know, I think with temperatures as they are, I think even just getting a little snow, I think once we do get it, it'll stick pretty quick. Because even in the interior, the ground is, you know, it's not 40, 50 degrees. It's more like 35.
Okay.
So I think once the weather pattern changes, and it is cooler in the interior, they've gotten a little snow here and there.
Mm-hmm.
I think once we get a good storm, it'll stick around.
And I guess Fairbanks has been pretty snow, you know, less snowy than usual, eh?
Yeah. It looks like if they don't get at least half an inch of snow today, which is, it's not likely that they will, it's going to be the first time on their period of record since 1900 that they've had no days with at least half an inch of snow on the ground in September or October.
Mm. Well, this is discouraging. But is there anything about these patterns? I mean, well, we've had obviously a very unusual year for weather, but is there anything particular about these patterns that is causing this, or is it sort of just one of these things that where there's a lot of variability and unpredictability in the weather, and so who knows?
Yeah, I think that's probably what it is this year. It's just this, you know, things have kind of lined up in such a way that we have this this persistent area of warm air essentially across the eastern Pacific going up into Alaska and western Canada. And right now, it's not as strong or warm as it was, say, earlier this week or the past couple weeks. And it looks like going into next week, it's going to be cooler than it has been. But still, it's sort of the same pattern. Looks like it may continue for another few weeks, potentially.
Mm-hmm. So, Dylan, I know you are leading skiers and you are skiing all the time yourself and doing dry land training and waiting for snow. It seems like it's probably what everybody's talking about. It's like, when is it going to snow?
It is. It's a big subject of discussion among skiers in town right now. I think for a lot of people who are looking forward and anticipating the winter and are thinking about skiing, then this time of year, starting, probably the 1st of October, people really start to focus and think about it and look forward to it. And when that first bit of termination dust hits the peaks behind town, then the conversation really ramps up.
Yeah. Well, I know you grew up in Anchorage, as I did, and I kind of remember a lot of years when the snow sort of started during the World Series, you know, or like the end of baseball season outside, you'd be getting snow here. And It seems like I mostly remember snow on Halloween.
I do too. As a little kid, I can't remember too many Halloweens going without a snowsuit.
Yeah, exactly. So I guess that's one plus for the kids, is they get to actually wear their Halloween costumes. What do competitive skiers do when they're waiting for snow?
This time of year, a lot of running, both using classic poles for the uphills or just regular running. Some workouts can still be done on the bike or on the roller skis as long as there's not too much frost on the pavement. And then Hatcher's Pass, Independence Mine, up in the state park up there, has snowfall right now, and that's always an early season destination, especially for cross-country skiers, to go and get some training time on snow.
So are your teams heading up there and to ski?
Yeah, mostly on the weekends. A lot of folks, not just from our program, but all across the city, are heading that direction.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. So, Travis, what about you? Do you sort of get anxious about snow, or are you more of a zen-like person who just doesn't worry about it?
No, I'm not zen-like at all when it comes to snow. And I have to admit, I was up at Hatcher this morning and enjoying some fresh snowflakes up there.
Did you get up real early
today
to get up there?
Yeah, though, with it being so dark in the morning,
you can't go too early. Yeah.
You can't go too early. So we got there basically just as the light was getting light enough to ski. And it was beautiful up there today.
So what was it like? Is it groomed for classic and skate skiing?
It is groomed for classic and skate. It was a little rainy earlier today and yesterday, and there was fresh snowflakes falling, so it was a little bit of a challenge for kick wax, for classic skiing. Mm-hmm. They've been grooming up there, and it looks beautiful. And as soon as you get to the A-frames up there, all of a sudden you're in a winter wonderland. So It's definitely worth doing.
And then coming back down is kind of a bummer.
Yes, coming back down, you go back right back into the rain. And
the dark rain, It always strikes me that if Anchorage was like November all the time, it would be unbearable. You know, it'd be sort of dark and wet. And, you know, it's when the snow comes, it brightens up and becomes like, becomes Anchorage again, at least to me.
Does. I also notice it in people's moods around town. Mm-hmm. Everything perks up once there's a nice, clean blanket of snow on the ground.
Yeah, yeah. So, Travis, when the snow actually starts, I mean, what makes rain become snow? What's happening with the physics of snow when snow originates up in the sky?
Well, what you have is you have clouds at high altitude, usually around 20,000-30,000 feet. And in those clouds, you have water vapor. And even though it can be quite cold in those clouds, it can be down as low as 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is well below the freezing point, the water vapor is saturated, super saturated, and it basically stays in that state until there is something to stick to. So if you have dust particles in the air, then eventually those water molecules will start to stick to the dust. And because of the shape of the water molecule, it's a bent shape, the water molecules stack together to form into hexagons. They form into these hexagonal prisms. And that's the starting point for all snow. And then that starts to fall out of the cloud. And depending on the temperature and the humidity inside the cloud, as that prism is falling, it will start to grow into the snowflakes that we know. And if you've ever taken the time to look at snow, you'll notice that it comes in a wide range of shapes and sizes. And that's because as the snowflake is falling, it moves through different zones of temperature and humidity, and that affects how it grows. So you get the classic stellar dendrite shapes that we think of as snowflakes, but you get also a wide range of other shapes. And so depending on the temperatures, the kind of snow we get varies a lot.
Mm-hmm. And we've actually got a chart on the website that you provided that shows the different shapes that snow crystals take at different temperatures. And I guess the vertical axis here is supersaturation, so that's how much moisture is in the air.
That's right. It's essentially a measure of how much humidity there is. And then the horizontal axis is a measure of temperature. And it's a little confusing, but I think the key thing to understand from this diagram is that the more humid it is, the more complex a snow shape you get.
Right. So folks who want to find that, if you go to alaskapublic.org, alaskapublic.org, and then just click on Snow Show and scroll down, you'll find Travis's interesting, informative chart, which I'm sure we'll be referring back to some more. So Halloween night snow, we're going to be out trick-or-treating and the snow is going to start falling tonight. Actually, a couple of years ago, it did snow on Halloween night, and I made this costume for my daughter. She was a sea anemone, and she had all these fabric things coming out of the top of it. And as the night went on, it got heavier and heavier and heavier. until she was staggering. She could barely walk through the streets with this enormous thing on. So maybe snow will hold off for one day. But the snow that first falls, it seems like it's often those huge snow crystals that sort of float gently downwards. Is that because it's very moist and very warm, that's the combination? Or why do we often see that at the beginning of the year?
That's exactly right. Usually at the beginning of the season, it's warmer. Warmer air can hold more moisture, and so the humidity is quite high. And so as those snowflakes fall, they can grow to be quite big. They can grow to be as large as about a quarter of an inch. As we get further into the season, as it's colder, then there's less humidity in the air, and so they tend not to get quite as big. But what's more important is actually what's going on in the cloud rather than the temperature down here on the ground.
Okay. And I imagine a lot of snow starts out in the cloud and makes it partway to the earth and then turns into rain. I mean, this may be snow that's falling on us right now and turning into rain as it falls.
Oh, absolutely. If you're, for example, driving up to Hatcher Pass, mm-hmm. as you might, the snowflakes, the rain that you're getting down at lower altitudes is snow higher up. And so a lot of this is starting as snow and then turning into rain, but it doesn't go the other way. Rain does not turn into snow.
All right, got you. It's Outdoor Explorer, the snow show this week, and I'm Charles Woolforth, and that was Travis Rector you're just hearing. He's a professor at UAA, and Dylan Watts, a coach at the APU Nordic Ski Center, and Gene Petrescu, regional scientist for the National Weather Service, is also with us. Gene, you contributed to the website this chart that shows date of first measurable snow in Anchorage, Alaska. And folks can find that again at alaskapublic.org and click on Snow Show, and there it is. And so you've got these blue dots, which I guess are the actual dates, and then you've got sort of a trend line, which is the red line. And it's quite a long time period, going back to 1930 here. And I don't know if I'm overreading it, but it looks like kind of flat, and then around 2005, the date gets much later. Am I over-interpreting this data?
Well, that's exactly what the data shows.
Yeah.
And it's sort of interesting that for many decades, the first average date of first snow in Anchorage, average over a decade at least, was about the middle of October, October 15th, 16th, 17th. Year to year,
So Dylan and my childhood memories were accurate.
Yeah.
Okay, good.
Year to year changed, a few mm-hmm. weeks later, a few weeks earlier, but the average was about, if you average 10 years out, it was about the same. But then seems like things changed about 2000, 2001, where suddenly now, if you take the last 10 years and average it, it's the end of October.
Mm-hmm.
And but looking at the average October temperature trend, it doesn't show this big, huge rise in temperature. I mean, it's a little bit warmer, but some of the years are like this where it's really warm. We don't get snow. Other years we've had, the past 10 years have been pretty cold in October, but it's been dry. So there's been no snow because it's been dry. So it seems like it's different reasons why we're not getting snow until later on average.
So does that mean it's hard to find a cause? I mean, you'd naturally say, well, global warming, later snow go together. But if it's not because of temperature, then maybe that's not a cause.
Yeah, it seems, interesting data that we just looked at last week and really don't have a good reason for it at this point. Just to say that also that it seems like it's more of a south-central, southern Alaska trend, but yet in the interior, the date seems to be pretty uniform, even through the last decade.
Okay. So are there indicators that you can look at, like sea surface temperature or El Nino, La Nina, or sea ice cover, or anything like that, that let you predict the severity of winter or the onset of winter?
There are certain things that, patterns, correlations with El Nino that help. An El Nino, for instance, tends to be somewhat warmer on average, especially over southern Alaska. But with precipitation, it's harder to forecast. And so we've had some fairly good snow years with El Nino and some poor snow years with El Nino. La Nina, again, on average, this is not every La Nina, but mostly they tend to be somewhat colder and somewhat drier. But yet, 2 years ago, we had a lot of snow, and it was La Nina. So it's a little hard to correlate some things. But temperature seems to play out fairly well.
Mm-hmm.
Separate from El Nino or sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska, And that tends to go, if it's warmer sea surface temperatures, we do tend to have warmer winters. And if it's colder, we do tend to have colder winters.
Mm, which obviously makes sense, yeah. So what do those indicators tell you now? Are there any clues to what we might be looking forward to?
This year, there's not a lot to go on. The sea surface temperatures in the Gulf of Alaska are you know, a little bit colder than average, but actually just 2 months ago, they were warm. But they've trended back down a little bit colder at the present time. And with El Nino, La Nina right now, it's fairly neutral. Mm-hmm. So it doesn't look like there's a lot to go on for this winter in terms of temperature. And then snowfall is, again, another layer of difficulty.
Right, because there's a lot more variables involved.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And it's highly localized. I mean, if we get a ton of snow right in Anchorage, we don't care if they have it somewhere else. I mean, from Anchorage perspective, I guess if your listeners in Talkeetna are care about this snow up there, but it can be... A snowstorm can be in a pretty small place, can it?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, depending on the situation, it could just be, a narrow snowband, 3-4 miles wide in some cases.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were on the other show back in the spring when we did a show on, like, what's with the weather and the fact that we've had sort of month after month of strange, extreme weather. A year ago, we had these huge storms, and then we had a very late winter, a late onset of winter, and the winter lasted a long time. And then it kind of switched very suddenly to a very warm summer, a very dry, warm early summer. Now we seem to be back into another weird October. It seems like we've had record months of one kind of another, but there's no real pattern there that seems evident.
Yeah, it's been interesting. And like you said, I think every month in the past 12 or 13 months, we've been close to some sort of record. Yeah, record dry, record wet, record cold, record warm. And I think just joking with my colleagues, it's like, okay, what's this next month going to bring?
Yeah, right.
What extreme are we going to see this next month?
Makes life more interesting at the Weather Service, I guess. I suppose it's already always pretty interesting. I love looking at their website.
I do too.
Oh, there's tons of information there. And I agree with you, Dylan. Reading the discussion of the forecast discussion is really interesting. Even though I don't understand... a third of it, and talking about comparing these different models, which is the right model to use. It's fascinating. So thanks for putting all that information out there. Yeah. And by the way, if you guys have any questions for each other, you all have different areas of expertise. Go for it. You were talking to Dylan about watching the weather, but that's just sort of like, I mean, it wouldn't matter if you watched it or not, right? I mean, it's not really going to affect how you prepare skis and that sort of thing.
Right. I guess with ski preparation, it's very much the day of determines a lot of the preparation. But past history of snow helps to give an idea of changes in the snowpack, things that need to be done, maybe to help improve the skis. And watching weather, too, it gives you, if you're familiar with your local area and observe the pattern, sometimes you can have a small heads up. Mm-hmm. What's going to happen that you're not surprised on the day.
I think it'd be worthwhile to help listeners understand, and I guess I don't really understand. I mean, I know that you put wax on the skis because it makes them go faster, but the importance of wax and why it makes such a big difference for skis, not only skis, but dog sleds, downhill skis, snowboards, everything depends on wax. What's so special about wax?
Wax is special because it's basically, you're lubricating the surface, the interaction between the ski and the snow. And even though snow and the material on a ski base can have a very low coefficient of friction or very low friction, like a slippery surface, the wax helps improve that even further. And it reduces the drag, or it helps, in some cases, it's hydrophobic, and so it helps repel water that might be in the snowpack to keep the ski from sticking to the surface.
All right, so different kinds of snow, obviously, call for different kinds of wax. And if you put the wrong kind of wax on, it's worse than not having any wax at all. I mean, you can just make your ski stop.
Yes, you can. You can use something that's, at least in cross-country skiing, right, there's kick waxes, too, which are to increase friction.
Explain for a listener who knows nothing about skiing, kick wax and glide wax?
Right. So a ski has two parts in the classic style, a part that glides and a part that is compressed into the snow to give grip or grab to the snow base. And so one of the components is actually sticky to touch, and against the snow, it deforms against the snow's shape to, mm-hmm. to give grab. And you could use something that was too soft on a wax mixture that was too soft for a very hard and aggressive snow, and it would stick you to the in place, and mm-hmm. that would be it would be detrimental to enjoyment of skiing.
Yeah, well, and you know, the recreational skier doesn't have to worry about too much about it. I mean, but some. I mean, really, it really greatly detracts from the enjoyment of skiing if the wax is just totally off.
It does, and I think in Anchorage we're quite lucky because generally through the winter we have fairly stable snow on the city trails, and so oftentimes it's not overly complicated to choose a wax that works in a very broad range of temperatures and snow types, mm-hmm. and to have an enjoyable ski with it.
Well, and I want to get a lot more into the sort of the waxing and the issues of how to wax. But in terms of like the beginning of the season, any tips sort of on if you've had your skis stored properly over the winter, they've had some kind of wax on them. Maybe people haven't. What do you do at the beginning of the season? Is there a formula, or is it just sort of look for the weather and figure out what you need to do?
I usually just let the weather determine what I need to do. Take the skis out of storage, scrape off any old wax or wax I put on for summer storage, and then...
Do you put some kind of a base on before your glide wax?
Yes. With waxing skis, generally in Anchorage, I put on a colder wax for durability, to hold other waxes to the ski, or for... Mm-hmm. Oftentimes, November, we can get a hard, cold snap that's, temperatures will drop into the single digits, and colder wax is always better.
Right. Now, there are binders for your kick wax. Is there some kind of binder that you want to put on as a preliminary base for your glide wax as well?
No, I never worry too much for that. Usually a green glide wax, mm-hmm. is a good place. Yeah.
So you can put a warmer wax over a colder wax.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So Travis, I mean, in terms of these different waxes, they're all because of different qualities of the snow, the sharpness or the smoothness or the wetness of the snow. Does most of that take place after the snow is transforming on the ground, or is it like it's controlled by what the temperature was like when the snow fell?
When considering the wax that you want, and first thing I'd just mm-hmm. like to say, when I first started skiing, I was obsessed with wax, and I was terrified that I had the wrong wax for the day, and I was mm-hmm. certain I was going to have an awful experience because, you know, I should have had the green instead of the blue. And I see this paralysis in a lot of skiers when they first start. And as I've been skiing more and more, I've realized the wax isn't as important as you think it is. Mm-hmm. And that's something I think is especially important for getting started, is you can start to feel like, oh my God, what am I going to do today? And then you get to the point where you just don't want to ski.
Right.
So it's not that important.
But it's fun. It's a fun part of the sport too. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners are skiers, and they're always sort of like thinking about.
For some people, the wax is half the fun, and for other people, it's none of the fun.
Yeah.
And maybe that's the easiest way to divide uh-huh. the two groups of skiers. And I love wax, and I love playing with them. But to answer your original question, the wax really depends on the history of the snow. First and foremost, what was the temperature and humidity when the snow fell? If it was a cold, dry snow to start off with, you can think of it as being kind of like shards of glass, just very sharp snowflakes that can grab into the wax. And so you want a harder wax that can keep those snowflakes from sticking in there for the glide wax. And then over time, the snow degrades. The snowflakes start to break down. The little sharp edges get worn off. And then it becomes eventually kind of more like ball bearings. And so the temperature and the humidity, and then the history of the snow. How old is it? How
long
is
it? We're talking basically at a microscopic level. You can't really see it. You just have to sort of know what the quality of it is.
Yeah, and that's important, is to think about the surface of the ski. What's really happening between the snow and the ski is happening on a microscopic level. And so you can think of it, again, as the wax is trying to dig into. Is the wax is either helping the snow dig into it, like in the case of kick wax, or it's helping to prevent it in the case of glide. And then in general, the colder it is, the firmer a wax you're going to want, the harder a wax, and then the warmer it is, the softer a wax you'll want.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot more to talk about on this topic, and we're going to be back in the second half to do that. I've got three guests who know a lot, and I'm enjoying learning from them. You just heard from Travis Rector, who's a professor at UAA, a professor of astronomy. He could talk about space snow later, maybe, but also of physics, and makes a avocation also of studying snow. He's also a great skier. Dylan Watts, a coach at APU Nordic Ski Center, past winner of the Tour of Anchorage and many other races. And Gene Petrescu is a regional scientist with the National Weather Service and has all the knowledge about weather and has been giving us all this discouraging news about when it's going to snow. So we'll be back in the second half with a lot more on this topic, so stay with us. But right now it's time for the Outdoor Explorer Calendar. The Center for Alaskan Coastal Studies invites Alaskans of all ages and abilities to take part in the Wind Nature Center 50-Mile Challenge. Snowshoe, ski, walk, or run, log miles at the 140-acre Wind Nature Center in Homer, or another Alaska trail of your choice. Sign up and get your challenge kit this Saturday, November 2nd, at the Rotary Health Fair in Homer, or email info@akcoastalstudies.org to sign up. The 50-mile challenge ends on June 7th with the grand prizes awarded by the Wind Nature Center season opening potluck on June 14th, 2014. This Saturday, November 2nd at Goose Lake Park in Anchorage, don't miss Story Tracks, Picture Books on Parade, a new family-friendly activity that combines reading and the great outdoors. Families travel from one page to the next as they read the book together while walking on our beautiful trails. This program is free and starts at 2 p.m. this Saturday. For more info, go to bestbeginnings.org. Sunday, November 10th, learn more about ski joring, winter fun with your dog, at the Eagle River Nature Center. Members of the Anchorage Ski Jor Club will cover choosing equipment, training and feeding your dog, as well as the best places to ski jor recreationally, and competition opportunities from local races to the World Ski Jor Championships. This free program starts at 2 p.m. on Sunday, November 10th. For more information, go to ernc.org. And we are going to have to do a ski joring show on Outdoor Explorer. That's going to be on our calendar. So you'll find all of those events on our website as well. But I also want to mention, finally, the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage annual meeting and ski swap is this Saturday, November 2nd at the Kincaid Chalet and Bunker in Anchorage. To tell us more about the event, we have with us by phone Ellen Toll from the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage. Hi, Ellen.
Hey, Charles.
Well, thanks very much for being with us. And I know you're doing your snow dance, hoping for snow, just like everybody in the studio.
Oh, yeah. Yep, it's looking a little too liquid out my window here today, but...
Yeah. We're all hoping for cooler weather. In any event, skiers can get together this weekend and talk about it and get their gear in shape, eh?
That's correct. Yeah, on Saturday out at Kincaid, the Nordic Skiing Association has got a bunch of stuff going on, but the first thing that is happening in the afternoon is a ski swap.
Mm-hmm.
And people who want to sell their gear need to bring it to Kincaid to the big gray wax bunker up there by the Kincaid Chalet between 1 and 3 p.m. You can bring, mostly we look for Nordic gear, but we will sell, you know, any other winter clothing or, you know, AT stuff, whatever people have to sell, we'll put it out there and see if anybody wants to buy it. And then...
So they bring it 1 to 3 and then it sort of goes on display after that?
Right. Well, then there's going to be an hour where volunteers from the Nordic Skiing Association sort of organize it all and, you know, put prices on it and get it all out there. And then people who want to buy can do so between 4 and 6 p.m. But nobody will be allowed into the wax bunker between 3 and 4. So if you want to drop off, it really needs to be there by 3. And then if you want to buy, get there by 4.
All right. And this is a pretty good opportunity to pick up used equipment and sort of get yourself set up for Nordic skiing on a budget. Maybe get a second set of skis or get some rock skis or skis for the kids.
Exactly. Yeah, there is always a lot of stuff, and people there to help you pick stuff out. If you're a beginner and you really don't know what you're looking for, there will be people circulating around who can kind of help you choose. There's always a lot of equipment, and it's a little bit crazy, but, you know, there's good stuff to be found.
Is it like the other swaps where you really want to be at the door the minute they open to grab the best stuff?
Well, I bet there will be a lot of people lined up at 4 o'clock.
All right. Yeah. Okay. So she's.
But you know, then it slows down, and there's still good stuff. I mean, if you really don't like that kind of crazy crowd, you know, come at 4:30, and there'll still be equipment there.
All right.
You know, the really hot deals may have walked out the door, but you know, not every pair of skis works for every person. So it just depends on what you're looking for.
So then the annual meeting follows that?
That's correct, yeah. So the ski swap is 4 till 6, and then at that same time, between 4 and 6 in the chalet, there's going to be all kinds of booths set up with membership information, different program information, you know, booths about all of the programs that Nordic Skiing Association does. And then at 6 o'clock, we have a potluck dinner. We supply brats. The people from APU come and grill them for us, but it is a potluck, so people who want to come should bring a side dish or a dessert, and you know, it's always good food. And then at 6:30 we have our annual meeting, which is just, you know, information about Nordic skiing, what's happened in the past year, and usually there's a slideshow, and it's a great way for skiers to get together and see each other after maybe not seeing each other for the summer, and talking about skiing.
And learn more about what getting involved in the skiing community. Yeah. So this is all coming up this Saturday. And give us your pitch for the trail pin, Ellen, because I'm always surprised. I run into people who don't know about trail pins and don't know that they're not helping pay for our ski trails in Anchorage.
Well, the Nordic Skiing Association grooms 140 kilometers of trail in Anchorage and Eagle River. So we groom all of the trails at Kincaid and Hillside and out in Eagle River at Mirror Lake and Chugiak. And we do it solely based on donations from skiers. And the municipality does not pay us to groom trails. They, you know, they give us a bunker to work out of Kincaid, but we're doing it using our own funds. So we need people to buy trail pins, because that's how we pay for these incredible trails that we have all over Anchorage. And you can chip in, buy a pin. There's different membership levels. You get a cool pin with a bear on it and a sticker for your car to show that you're supporting our grooming efforts. And it's not just the winter. We do summer maintenance. You know, we're out there cutting grass, making sure there aren't fallen trees, and fixing the trails when they need it. And
most important, you get to know that you contributed, you did your part, and you paid for the facilities that you're using. And then you're also a member of the Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage.
Right, right.
All right. Well, thanks, Ellen. That was Ellen Toll with the NSAA, Nordic Ski Association of Anchorage. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Have fun on Saturday. And you can find out more about the Ski Swap and Celebration annual meeting and all the other events we mentioned on today's Outdoor Explorer calendar at alaskapublic.org. Click on today's show or the logo for Outdoor Explorer. And please stay with us for the second half of the show. We'll continue to talk about snow when Outdoor Explorer continues.
You are listening to Outdoor Explorer from KSKA Anchorage. You can find Outdoor Explorer on Facebook and iTunes. To see what's coming up on future programs and add your voice to the conversation, go to alaskapublic.org.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth, and our topic today is snow. We're all wishing for snow, and we're not jinxing it. We've decided that the snow gods will smile upon us for thinking about snow, and they will grant us our wish eventually. But we actually have some rather scientific people in the room who probably don't even believe in jinxes. Dylan Watts is a coach with the APU Nordic Ski Center and a skier and an expert ski wax technician.
Sure.
There's a word for it. Travis Rector, professor at UAA, and Gene Petrescu is a regional scientist for the National Weather Service. Gene, I wanted to test a pet theory on you, which is that I've noticed of many falls of wishing that the snow would come, that it seems like we have a lot of precipitation in Anchorage starting in August and kind of through October, and then we tend to get drier into December and January. And if the temperature doesn't get down far enough, you know, if it was cold right now, we would have tons of snow outside with all this precip we're getting. But those years when it doesn't get cold until later in the year, often we'll have long periods when it's cold enough, but there's no snow because simply there's no precip because we've kind of missed that window. Is that just my imagination, or is that a real thing that those patterns of precip and cold kind of have to line up a little bit?
Well, yeah. First, I mean, the wettest time of the year in Anchorage is that August, October timeframe, and you're right; it does get drier after that as the storm track tends to shift south, and we tend to get the colder air coming in from the north, the drier, colder air. And I guess that's the old, you know, one of the questions is, I mean, you know, if like on Monday we had all that rain. Well, if it was cold enough, we would have had so much snow, but then, if we had that same weather pattern, we probably still would have been rain because
it's a warm weather pattern.
Right, okay. It's a warm weather pattern. But I think to some degree, I think you're, you know, possibly correct in that, you know, things have to, I'll call use phase properly. They have to kind of occur in certain sequences for things to happen. But you know, every year is different. You know, things can align just right, in December, or, you know, October, November, December, to give us a lot of snow. Then it can dry out. Then we can get more snow. It's pretty random in, mm-hmm. in many ways. But yes, we do tend to get about 50% of our snow in Anchorage before January 1st. So at least half of the snow tends to fall in the fall and early winter.
Mm. And then a lot of times we'll get a ton of snow in March, but January, February will be pretty dry, not too much snow. Yeah. So. I know what the weather pattern looks like, or what the radar looks like, when we're going to get sort of a Chinook, kind of wet air off the ocean, and it's coming directly from the south and sort of like shoots us all this stuff. What's the weather pattern that we should be looking at that would give us hope for snow? I mean, what is it? Where does that come from?
There's you know, certainly different patterns, but I think that, you know, the best ones tend to be when a low will track to the south of us and move into Prince William Sound and weaken at that point. That's generally a good one. Or if the storms tend to come in, you know, sort of from the west, but still just south of Anchorage and continue moving on, mm-hmm. In what we'll call more of a progressive pattern. But in most cases, and this isn't every case, but in most cases, we get our snow after the storm has gone through. So on the backside of the storm.
Why would that be?
Well, typically on the front side of the storm is when we're getting those Chinooks, when we're getting the warm air, we're getting the winds. So it's mm-hmm. it's so once that the surface
that big circular thing that's coming through.
Yeah, okay. The big low. If once that moves to the west or east of us, excuse me, or inland a little bit, then our surface winds will switch from being this Chinook easterly wind or southeasterly wind to come more from the southwest or which brings moisture from Cook Inlet and pushes it up against the Chugach Mountains.
Mm. So when it moves up the mountains, it cools down and condenses into snow?
Right.
Huh, interesting. So but as you say, that I mean, we can see a few days out, a week out, but we really can't see beyond that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think, of course, we're getting better, the model's getting better, so we can, you know, often get indications that something may happen a week out, maybe in a little bit longer. But then as the event gets closer and closer, we can see more details in most cases. In some cases, Things happened very quickly. Still the models may not handle things very well. And so we definitely can still get those surprises, which mm-hmm. I always love.
Yeah. So when we talk about first snow, is it the first measurable snow? Is it the first trace of snow? How do you define first snow?
It's the first measurable snow, which is a tenth of an inch.
Okay.
And, this year, most areas of Anchorage have actually gotten snow back in September, mm-hmm. and actually quite a bit in some areas. But at the official measuring site at the Weather Service office near the airport, they have not had measurable snow yet.
Interesting. Yeah, it's funny that the fact that the Weather Service building is in kind of an odd area seems to affect a lot of our records, doesn't it? It's right near the water. It's actually a warmer spot than most of town, I think.
Well, I think, across the country, most official observing locations are at airports or near airports, which is goes back to World War II. Mm-hmm. And in Anchorage, because of its location away from the mountains and close to Cook Inlet, it's warmer in the winter, warmer at night, cooler in the summer. They generally get less snow than the rest of town. It definitely is a bit of a different climate than say eastern Anchorage.
But pretty well located for our best ski area, which is Kincaid.
Yes.
Although the season at Kincaid is shorter than anywhere else in town. I mean, the Russian Jack has a longer season service, and then, of course, going up to the valley much longer.
Yeah, that's, in my experience, generally Kincaid has a shorter snow season than the rest of town.
And the wind makes a big difference, too. And Travis, you were talking about the different qualities of snow and how they affect wax. It seems like as snow is transformed through the winter by wind, by thaw and freeze cycles, that really affects how it interacts with skis. Right, Dylan?
It does. It's snow is a very dynamic, like water is a dynamic substance. And as a snowpack can transform, and I think anyone can who's lived in Anchorage for at least a winter can visualize how as snow sits on the ground, it both compresses under its own weight and also the weight of use if someone walks on it or drives a machine over it, skis over it, and it compacts. As wind blows across, as temperature cycle and change, as the sun hits it, the snowpack changes in different ways. And so those crystalline shapes change over time. Sometimes it seems that humidity comes out of the snow, the snowpack dries, or it becomes wetter if it rains on the snow. And, dirt, birch seeds, all sorts of things fall into the snowpack, and that creates another obstacle mm-hmm. to glide or low friction. And so
is it when you're at the high level, not sort of the weekend skier who just is out to have fun, but sort of the high end competition, is the waxing more science or more sort of art and craft? And you've seen this, you've seen that. Because I know there's a million different kinds of wax. There's a million different ways you can put it on. And it seems like, I don't know that there's too many scientists out there doing studies to find out, with blind experiments as to which is really the best.
Yeah, there is some scientific research that's been published, but it's generally it's not a big area, big mm-hmm. field of study. It's kind of more for fun little projects. Certainly the wax companies test extensively in their products and have chemists on staff who work with their equipment. I think
but when you're out,
when I'm working on making a wax recommendation for a lot of people, say in one of the local races or the Tour of Anchorage, it's both art and observational science. And so a lot of what I do when I'm looking at waxing skis for best possible speed for competition, then you're looking at both your observations that you make on the snow and the temperature, and then with past experience, what you know about wax and how that interacts with a ski, and then it's through a series of testing the different waxes on the snow to determine which one would be best for conditions.
So you wax a whole bunch of different skis and try them?
That's right. Yep. Mm-hmm. Just try them and feel them one-to-one. The application part, that's more art form and craft. And there is certainly a way of doing it that leads to better results than some ways if you just mm-hmm. glop it on there and then you just have lumps on the ski. Mm-hmm. And so It's you're looking to polish the surface in a lot of ways.
So I know you've been involved. I mean, our local races are, you know, pretty high level races. Mm-hmm. People are serious, but I mean, getting up to the Olympics, getting up to national championships, which we had here in Anchorage. Tell us, like, the scene as you're leading up to the race. What kind of intensity is happening? What kind of stuff is happening? How many resources are dedicated to just the waxing?
It's interesting. At the very highest levels of competition on the World Cup, a lot of the teams have semi-trucks that are outfitted just for ski waxing, both on the Alpine and now on the Nordic side as well. And they bring a team of technicians to work on skis, and these technicians are out testing a bunch of factors. Wax is a factor. The skis themselves are a factor.
Because the best skiers will have a whole fleet of skis for different soft snow, hard snow, cold, warm.
That's right, yeah, because the snow being dynamic, there's the compaction factor, which is actually a lot of drag. And that's why you see folks who are backcountry skiing in the mountains, like in Turnagain Pass, are on very wide skis mm-hmm. that maybe look more like water skis than where a Nordic ski is a very narrow mm-hmm. Positive cambered ski, or what is like it's bent like a bow would be bent. And so they're testing that. They're testing the patterning on the bottom of the ski and because of that affects the interaction with the snow. And then they're testing the wax on top of that, the lubrication to make the ski
faster.
And then
there'll also be patterning put into the wax at the end.
Yes, that's right. Yeah, like so the final bit, sometimes people roll in another what's called structure into the base of the ski to form another pattern that helps. Usually it's designed to help shed excess water that's forming between the snow and the ski.
So when is, like, does this work go on till like 30 seconds before the race, or is it like, is it like pushing it to the last minute to make sure you get it perfect?
It can. Generally, it doesn't have to be quite that last minute. Mm-hmm. You can, in Anchorage, you know, if you're familiar, you can make a call a couple of days out and be accurate. And it's
as long as Gene and his staff do their job correctly.
Well, I mean, I think even, you know, it's not so fine in ranges, right? Like, uh-huh. I think if you become too narrow and specific, then you can miss it because it's not only the weather itself. It's maybe there's trees shading a part of the course, or there's wind in another mm-hmm. part, or there's, you know, the birch seeds have dropped on another part. And so generally, if you're fairly broad in your spectrum and you have a big range, then you're okay, and very mm-hmm. little can go wrong then.
But at the Olympics, I assume they would just be pushing it to the last minute to get perfection.
Yeah.
How much, what percentage, I mean, you've skied at an elite level. What percentage of your race is really wax as opposed to fitness and technique?
Oh, I'd say 3 to 10%.
Right. Yep. Yeah. And, you know, I'm thinking that if I could have the best skis in the world, and Travis and Dylan could have the worst, and they would still win by a lot. Right.
So it might have to work really hard to do it. I think if you look at the factors involved for snow sport, and then the driver of the skis or the snowboard the sled even is probably the most important factor. The greatest contributing mm-hmm. factor is going to be the athlete.
Right.
After that, the skis are very important. The quality of the material and their make, their flex against the snow. Are they fitted for the skier? Is the second most important factor. Third, I would say base condition. Is it in good shape? Is it rough and damaged, or has it been nicely cared for? And is there a pattern, a structure pattern on the bottom of the ski that either at cold temperatures helps make more free water to help lubricate the surface between the ski and the snow?
So a little water is good.
A little water is good. Too much is it creates suction against the ski, just as if you had a glass on a table and there was a little pool of water under it and you mm-hmm. went to lift it off. It would be more resistance than if it was dry underneath. And so that patterning can either help create more or less depending on need. And then the fourth factor I would say would be the wax,
right?
And how valuable the wax is.
I guess it depends on the event between the Olympic downhill, which takes a minute, and the 50K that takes a couple of hours. I mean, the fitness is going to be a bigger element in the 50K. And
The aerobic fitness, I think. Yeah. with alpine skiing, that's such a, you have to be such a well-balanced athlete to, mm-hmm. to race those events. You have to be, you know, strong and powerful. You have to have tremendous body awareness and control,
balance,
and courage. I mean, you know, to go careening down a hill near 100 miles an hour, you have to, you know, have the confidence and the skill level to do that. And so, you know, I think that in all snow sports, you have to have those things. But if your event is 3 minutes long versus 2 hours, you know, then the ratio shifts.
It's a very different balance.
It's just a different
age range appropriate.
Right.
It's Outdoor Explorer. I'm Charles Wolforth. We're talking about snow today. That was Dylan Watts, who's a coach at the APU Nordic Center. And earlier we heard from Gene Petrescu from the National Weather Service. Travis Rector is a professor at UAA. Travis, how does the, you know, we were talking about the form of snow crystals and the type of snow that falls and, you know, what snow is made of. Does it change during the course of the winter, the predominant type of snow that falls in Anchorage?
It's more sensitive to the conditions at the time that the snowfall. And you can actually have some types of snowflakes, like the traditional stellar dendrites, what we think of when we see a snowflake.
And that's sort of the no two snowflakes are like six.
The six star mm-hmm. shape. That's something that can be produced around 22 degrees Fahrenheit. It also can be produced at 5 degrees Fahrenheit. So you'll actually, that's a shape that you'll see at different types of the year. So as we already talked about, it's more a matter of the moisture content. As the season progresses, you can have colder, drier air. There's just less moisture in it, and so mm-hmm. you get less snow, and so you can get into these dry spells in the winter. One thing I think is important for people to understand is that people often think, oh, well, I looked out my window and, you know, it's 35 degrees and so I couldn't possibly go skiing today. And it's really more about the history of the snow and what's been done with it. And it's one of the sides of skiing that we seldom see. And this is another plug for the Nordic Ski Association. When it comes to grooming, the groomers are making very complicated decisions about how to groom the snow, when to groom the snow, what the weather pattern has been like, what the weather pattern will be like in the future. And it's really remarkable, using the machinery that they have, that even in conditions that we would think would not be very skiable, you can have perfect conditions out on the trails. And so,
and that's something we're very lucky about in Anchorage, because they've got this machinery where they can grind up ice and make it into a skiable material, which they don't have in other towns in Alaska, because it's very expensive equipment.
Yeah, and that's certainly a big part of the expense for the Nordic Ski Association, is to own and maintain these vehicles that can deliver this quality of mm-hmm. grooming.
It cost multiple hundreds of thousands of dollars, yeah.
Yeah, and especially at this time of year, once the snow first falls, people start thinking, okay, it's time to get out the machines and start packing it down and doing all these things. And there's a complex process that goes into the decision-making for when to groom, how to groom. And often those decisions are made with the long-term future in mind, that mm-hmm. you may hold off on the grooming a little bit, and that'll let the snow settle, compact, get you a better base, so we'll have great skiing in April.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about artificial snow? We've got the new snow cannons at Kincaid that kind of kept us skiing a little bit last winter. And then if you go to Alyeska or Hilltop to go downhill skiing, of course, a lot of the snow is going to be artificial. How does that differ from the snow that falls from the sky?
Well, microscopically, it looks not at all like snow. It looks like frozen water droplets, and that's because that's exactly what it is. The way these snow making machines work is they shoot water out with compressed air, and then once it goes into the atmosphere, it expands and cools and then freezes and then falls as the snow we see. And it's great skiing. It's plenty skiable, but microscopically it looks very different.
How does that stuff differ in terms of waxing, Dylan?
It's harder and more aggressive as against the ski base, so it rasps against the ski more. It's typically very fast, but it has a high moisture content to it.
And it's pretty dense on the ground.
And it's very dense on the ground, and so you have to wax both for durability, but also for, you have to have some hydrophobic properties in the wax as well to repel the excess moisture that can be in the snow.
keeping the water off the ski so it doesn't have that suction effect you're
talking
about?
Right, so it would basically bead off the ski, so it would just keep rolling off. It would be like the same finish you might have on a rain jacket, like a high-tech fabric, where it would it beads and just rolls right off instead of building up or running mm-hmm. off in rivulets. So,
Travis, do you have different skis for different times of year? Like you get out there when there's just a barely snow on the ground, skis that you don't mind running into a few rocks with?
Oh, sure. We all have what we call rock skis, which are the skis that you don't care what happens to them, which makes them your favorite skis in a lot of ways because you're not so worried about hitting rocks and all that.
You've probably had them for a while, yeah.
Well, every ski becomes a rock ski eventually. Right. You may not have chosen to turn it into a rock ski that day, and that's just what happens. Actually, I haven't used my rock skis yet this year because there was a big snowfall up at Hatcher Pass, and so it's great conditions, and I haven't needed them yet. But last year, for the first month and a half, I was pretty much on rock skis every day because the only snow in town was at Russian Jack and out on the golf course, and so you definitely needed them there.
And I'm interested in, from everybody here in the room, like how many skis you have, because, okay, you've got your... You maybe have your alpine, your downhill skis. You've got your backcountry skis. You've got your classic track skis for Kincaid. You've got your skate skis. Then you might have rock skis for your skate skis, rock skis for your classic skis. And then you might have skis for different conditions. And I'm going to say I probably have three or four pairs of skis. I'm like a ski poor person. Dylan, how many skis pairs of skis do you have?
Well, I'm going to preface this by saying I have a bit of a ski collection, and I collect old skis, old wooden skis. Maybe one day I'll build a fence out of them. But I actually
I'm not
use
counting
them.
The skis that can't be skied anymore.
Well, I do still ski them and tour on them. And so I have 30 pairs of skis.
Okay. And would you... Do you like have a tour of Anchorage or a big race? Would you, you know, and you know you're going to be skating, would you sort of have like a half a dozen skis to choose from that would be good for that day?
Yeah, maybe three pair that mm-hmm. would be race skis of that quality. Yeah.
Uh-huh. Travis?
Well, I'm glad Dylan answered that question first. I'll just say my wife and I, between the two of us, have about 18 pairs. I won't say how many of those are mine and how many are hers.
Do you, and Gene?
I hate to say this, but I like one non-working pair. I think I need to buy a new pair, but I'm much more of a snowshoer.
All right.
Alpine snowshoeing.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's fun, too. We're going to be talking about that on an upcoming show. And you know, I didn't count all the skis. I have four kids. Each of them has two pairs of skis. It's a lot of work waxing all the skis and getting ready for winter. I have to admit that I'm really not there yet, so I haven't been, like, you know, if we'd had a lot of snow, I would have had to rush out and get to work, and I haven't done that yet. Are you guys have already been up to Hatcher, so you're already.
Yeah, I've had quite a few skis already.
All right. Well, thanks, guys. This has been really interesting, and I've enjoyed it a lot. You heard from Travis Rector, who's a professor at UAA, Dylan Watts, a coach at APU Nordic Center, Gene Petrescu, regional scientist for the National Weather Service. Earlier, we heard from Ellen Toll, talking about the Nordic Ski Association Ski Swap and Annual Meeting, which is coming up on Saturday. On next week's show, we'll be talking about the Crow Pass Trail and its interesting history. If you have some Crow Pass history to share, please share it on the Outdoor Explorer Facebook page, easy to find. And we're going to have a historian, and we'll actually have a former Girl Scout who worked on the trail 40 years ago. Thanks for joining us today on Outdoor Explorer. Our producer is Kristen Platt. I'm your host, Charles Woolforth. I'll see you outside.
Outdoor Explorer is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Theme music is by Portugal the Man. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Outdoor Explorer and listen online at alaskapublic.org.
Life informed. This is Alaska Public Media.